From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last week when a local grassroots group made a historic announcement. The group filed an amendment to revoke racist property deeds in Brighton's Meadowbrook neighborhood. To help us understand the significance, here's a very brief history lesson for you. During the first half of the 20th century, developers, builders, and even governments used racially restrictive covenants to ban certain ethnic groups, in most cases people of color, from buying or occupying homes. While the Supreme Court ruled in 1948 that the covenants were unenforceable, and New York State made them illegal in 1962, thousands of property deeds here in Monroe County still contain those clauses. The impact that they've had is both tangible and intangible, but can be summed up as housing segregation by design. We had a conversation about this issue on Connections in August when a report released by the Yale researchers and City Roots Community Land Trust showed that the racist covenants existed in nearly every local suburb and in parts of the city. That included the Meadowbrook neighborhood in Brighton. It was built by Kodak and touted by that company in the 1930s for its racist covenants. But those covenants are now no more. A group of neighbors joined together, forming the Confronting Our Racist Deeds Committee, or CORD for short. They garnered additional support and successfully filed for an amendment with the county clerk's office to revoke the racist deed restrictions, and they replaced those covenants with anti-racist language. Today, we talk with members of CORD about their process and how other neighborhoods can take these steps. We'll also talk about the impact that these types of actions can have on addressing systemic racism. I'd like to welcome my guests for the hour. Janita Anthony is a member of CORD. Janita, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me again.
Absolutely.
Nice to be here.
Thank you. Kristen Dowdy is a member of CORD as well. Kristen, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Shane Wiegand is a board member of City Roots Community Land Trust and co-lead of the Pathstone Foundation's Anti-Racist Curriculum Project. Shane, welcome back to you.
Great to be here, Megan.
And Shane helped write the report on racially restrictive covenants in Monroe County, along with Connor Dwyer Reynolds, executive director of the Police Accountability Board. Connor, welcome to you.
Great to be here.
So we're going to hear from Janita and Kristen about their efforts in just a moment. But first, Connor, this is a direct follow-up to that discussion we had on the program in August. And I want to ask you, did you expect to see this kind of change happening in just months?
You know, I am so happy that folks in Meadowbrook got this done as quickly as they did. In so many of the communities across the country, you have these reports released, these racist deeds discovered, and little or nothing happens. And so having this first step happen just in a matter of months is good news.
And Shane, I tried to briefly explain some of the history, but really I should leave that to you. You've done phenomenal presentations that our listeners can find online. We can link to those as well. But just to give our listeners a sense of the history of the Meadowbrook neighborhood, what do we need to know about that and what the CORD group was confronting?
I think a key piece here is that this is a local business, kind of Kodak, building a neighborhood for its almost entirely white staff. And ensuring that it stays 100% white by writing deed restrictions that said no person of color could live in those homes. These were legally binding. And we know that when the redlining maps came out in Rochester several years after Meadowbrook had started to be built and populated, it was still 100% white. So we know these things were enforced and had influence in these neighborhoods. And that this was something that the head of the county government did. We had the head of the Builders Association, the Bar Association, the Real Estate Association. I mean, the powerful people in Rochester, the people of influence, were proud of what they were doing. They were supporting these racial covenants, and it was an intentional effort to keep our community segregated and to determine who could live where.
And I mentioned earlier, this is pervasive across Monroe County. I would say was, but many of these deeds still exist, as the neighbors in Meadowbrook have found. Shane, is there... I don't want to have you give us a list of all the communities because I feel like, you know, it'd be easier to say what's not on the list. But the point I'm trying to make is this is happening everywhere in the county.
It is. I mean, East Rochester, we've got Forest Hills, Parkcroft, Browncroft Neighborhood, North Winton, Beechwood, 19th Ward, Greece, Latona Homesteads, Dewey Stone Road Track, Gates. There's like four different neighborhoods, Chilai. Irondequoit has the most, from Somerville to Seneca Ridge to Rogers Park, Newport Heights, Culverton, that whole area by the high school. Forest Lawn and Webster, Daytona View and Penfield, Penfield Manor, Ellison Park Heights, Fair Acres and Fairport, Council Rock and Brighton still hasn't acknowledged these, Pittsford, East Avenue Estates, North Union Street and Spencerport, and that's just the tip of the iceberg of what we've found.
I have a few questions for you and Connor about, and perhaps the CORD group, about how you can find if your deed actually contains some of this language. I myself tried to look last night. I learned a lot about where I should look, so we'll talk about that in just a moment. But I'd like to turn to the CORD members, Janita and Kristen. Janita, when did you first learn about the history of Meadowbrook?
Well, I'm new to the Rochester area, so I've only been here for about 3 years. And when we moved here, we didn't even see our house. My sister-in-law actually looked at the house, said, you know, this will be great for you guys. We were looking to move to Brighton. So we moved in a little blind. I'm not even from the area, but my husband is from the city of Rochester. So I didn't initially know about them. And I guess speaking with one of my neighbors, it sort of came up. And I was like, oh, really? You know, and I wasn't surprised because I'm pretty positive that my neighborhood that I came from in Jackson Heights, which was one of the first suburbs of New York City, also contained covenants like this.
And when did you first hear about it? Was it when the report was released or when you...
It was before the report was released. But then, you know, the report was released and it's like, okay, this is glaring. This is right here in my backyard. There's no way to avoid it, you know. This is, you know, a time when we are all feeling really like we want to get engaged in acts around us. So this was just the time to do it when we heard about it after seeing the DNC article. Someone on Facebook actually posted, one of our neighbors, Ed Wiltsey, he posted on Facebook a message and he said, hey, guys, you know, look, the DNC and look at this report that came out about our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of responses.
Mm-hmm. Kristen, can I chime into that?
Absolutely. Yeah. What was that the same for you?
Yeah. Well, so I was just going to add that I've lived here about 9 years now, and I think most neighbors that I've talked to learned about it at their closing because you're required to sign these documents, and I think a lot of people saw that for the first time then and were really jarred. But you're already, you know, you're in the table, you're buying your house, so onward you go. But then I think it really became something you sort of didn't talk about in public. So I'll say that about a year ago, when the first reporting about the sort of about Shane's work and the pending report from City Roots came out, somebody posted about it on our neighborhood Facebook group. And what was striking to me was that at that point, very few people responded, right? And in fact, I got a lot of text messages about people saying, well, I know about this, it's in my deed, I'm so uncomfortable about it. But I raised this to say that people were aware of it. I think people knew about it. Most people, it was sort of a public secret, right? People knew that it was there. But to me, what has been really demonstrably different over the last year is that now people are willing to talk about it in public, right? So a year ago, when the first reporting in the DNC about this work, this collective work came out, people still felt uncomfortable, weren't willing to confront it. By this summer, when you have the full report, when you have a summer of activism across the nation by Black Lives Matter activists in the wake of the death of George Floyd, and then in our own city this fall, I think that absolutely created the conditions, the report and that political movement and the pandemic disproportionately impacting communities of color. People were sort of aware of these racialized issues in different ways, and perhaps it created different conditions for public conversations.
So do you think if this happened a year ago, that this report came out a year ago, do you think the community would have acted in the same way they did now? Or do you think these social conditions really set the stage for what happened with CORD?
In my view, we tried a year ago and it didn't work. Mm-hmm. And then we tried this year and it did work. So I really feel strongly that these broader conditions were really central to, you know, to the report, and people's willingness to mobilize really, really changed. But Janita, you might want to speak more to that.
I was just going to say I agree with Kristen. You know, just George Floyd and just Daniel Prude is really raw, and it was really and it's right here. And so it's like you're seeing this national stage, and then it's like, guess what? It's going on right here. And, you know, we have to do something because these are the forces that enable those things to happen.
Mm-hmm. Your group has done such a wonderful job creating a how-to guide, a communications kit. So if you live in a neighborhood where you think you have these racially restrictive covenants, the CORD group has created a map for you, a roadmap for how to go about revoking those deeds. And we're going to walk through that in a moment. But the question that I had earlier, and I'll turn this back to Connor, is if you're someone like me who's wondering, does my home have one of these restrictive deeds on it, where do you look? Because it's not in the place where I thought I would look.
Well, you know, these deeds are all down in books and microfilm reels down at the county clerk's office downtown. And so, you know, if you're someone like me who's read over thousands of these things, this thing can take about, you know, half an hour, 15 minutes to look up. But if you're new to this process, going down there, it can take hours to figure out, you know, looking your house up, finding the deed, and linking back through all of the deeds, you know, those documents that transfer the property from person to person, looking back all the way back, generations and generations, to find the one that has that original restriction, Blanding, likely Black and Brown people on it. And, you know, folks at the county clerk's office can be very helpful walking you through, helping you how to do some of this stuff. But I'm very thankful for the folks at Meadowbrook for publicizing these how-tos. And there's also more information on this in that report released by Yale and CityRoots that can help people, too. So if you want the more no details, please Google these resources.
Absolutely. And we'll link to those on our...
Sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
And to piggyback on that, you know, we did pick one of the paths because I know that Connor outlined, you know, about three, you know, a couple of different paths you can go. So these are one of the ways that you can go. And we just, you know, decided that this might be the fastest. And we figure if we get this started, then guess what? You know, the local Monroe County, the town of Brighton, they have to listen to us if we're already doing this.
And I know Bill Maley has touted your efforts and has expressed pride in what your neighborhood has done. It all started with that Facebook page, and you garnered some support among your fellow residents. Take us through the next few steps. I know there were some critical steps that had to be taken to build momentum, really, for filing this amendment. So, Janita, help us understand what happened after you had the group formed.
All right. So we had the group formed, and immediately we decided we would do weekly Zooms, and people volunteered for committees. We decided what were the most important things to do. You know, we needed people to communicate to our neighborhood. We needed people to organize signature events, because these signature events were the most important aspects of gathering the signatures. And so we were lucky enough to have a lawyer in our group who is very aware of, you know, these processes and what exactly we needed to do. And he created an amendment page for us. So this amendment would be a blanket amendment that would be attached to every single signature page. And so we used, it was a mail merge in Microsoft Word. And thank God we had a wonderful webmaster who could take all these documents and do this. It was a little beyond all of our technological capabilities. But he was able to create a mail merge for every single property. And the step before that I didn't mention is you have to identify what properties in your subdivision are encumbered by these covenants. So once we decided what properties were encumbered, we had these various groups that had to get together to decide, you know, what they would be responsible for. And we, you know, decided to do forest signature gathering events. We had no idea what to expect. You know, we hoped it would be widely supported. We anticipated it might, but we didn't know, you know, in our first gathering signature event, we didn't know if we would get, we thought we'd get 30 signatures, but we got 83.
Wow. And so by the final stage of the process, you exceeded the number of signatures you needed.
We did. And so what we did is we had these signature events. These were like on weekends. We had one weekday. You know, the last one, we still had a couple left. So we really looked to the people around us. We had a lot of volunteers, and they activated their own networks within our neighborhood. And they spoke to individuals. We made house calls. Notaries made house calls. These were socially distanced, too. You know, we were so creative. But at the end of the day, the thing that really kept this thing going was our drive. And we were really committed to doing this work. I think every single person was deeply committed to making this change. And, you know, we set a date of November 1st as our deadline initially in August, kind of laughing, like, I don't know if we'll get this done. And then we got it to October 31st. We did we met up at the corner of my block, and about eight of us, we went out with notaries, and side by side, we walked to neighbors' houses, and we got our final 6 to 8 signatures.
Kristen, do you think people were surprised to hear about these deeds, or do you think everyone was well-educated when you first began the process?
I think some people were surprised, some people knew. I think it depends. You know, we have a neighborhood that has a range of generations, right? There are people who have been living here for decades and people who just moved in. I mean, across the street from us,
when I mentioned we have a new neighbor who just moved in, and when I reached out to say, you know, we're doing this, would you be interested in signing, they said to me, oh my gosh, I'm so glad you raised this, because we just signed 3 months ago and we were horrified. We're so glad, you know, and we saw this covenant at signing, so we're so glad that we can, you know, sign our names here and be a part of this process of revoking this. So I think there's a real range. Families who have lived here longer, maybe somebody knew, the kids may or may not have known. So this question of to what extent it's been sort of public versus private, as I mentioned before, I think varies. And I guess I'll add, you know, I teach at U of R. I'm a faculty member there, and I've said this to the core group. You know, I've been struck by often my students there, students locally, students from Monroe County and the surrounding region, are totally unaware or have been historically of these dynamics in Rochester and Monroe County. Many of them had no idea that there were riots in the around race-related issues in the 1960s, right? So here, I think this question of whether people knew or didn't know is going to vary, and I think sometimes people sort of chose not to know. Mm-hmm. But there certainly was reputational stuff about Meadowbrook and these covenants and the ways that Meadowbrook chose to exclude people for generations that's sort of out there in the wind. So I'm sure listeners have their own views on what Meadowbrook is from the outside and whether people know or didn't know and were intentional or unintentional about excluding people.
Did anyone refuse to sign?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I would say that we have, the numbers, we got over 75. It was required in RD that we get 75% of the original 288 houses in order to make the change to the restrictive covenants. We got over that just barely, and then we stopped. But there were some people who just didn't sign because they, you know, were not well or we couldn't reach them, et cetera. But there were definitely people who explicitly told us that they refused to sign.
Did they explain why?
Yeah.
Do you want to go ahead, Jenny? Go ahead.
No, there's nothing to explain. I mean, we did, you know, these phone trees where we would call individual neighbors and say, hey, you know, so-and-so, I haven't seen you, you know, and so we got into conversations, but it was really interesting that, you know, some of these conversations converted people. So that was really nice that this was able to open this dialogue. You know, I know, for instance, one of our core members, her daughter is a notary, and she spoke to a number of her elder, you know, like her older neighbors, and she was able to get a few people to sign just by, you know, she never thought they were going to, and lo and behold, it took like a week or a couple of days, and they did sign.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll say that, and Janita, you should interrupt me if I'm mischaracterizing this. I would say the common responses when people wouldn't sign were either, A, they thought it was just symbolic, and that it was just about us patting ourselves on the back, and that it wouldn't have any transformative change. And so we have, you know, we can talk more about that. Some people said they felt like it was too divisive. And again, some of our, I think our argument to that, at least, you know, what I would say is, it's not that not talking about this is apolitical. Not talking about this is just maintaining of the status quo. And so, you know, how do we think about what it means to be divisive in this context? And then there were some people who felt that we were not representing the wideness of the range of people who had been historically excluded from Meadowbrook and other neighborhoods, that it was not only people of color, but also Jewish people, et cetera. And yeah. So they felt like they wanted the action to be broader than how they felt like perhaps we were constraining it. So I think there were a range of different responses to why people didn't want, those who didn't sign, didn't want to sign.
So for those people who say, you know, these are not enforceable anymore, they're illegal in New York State, what's the point of going through it? It's just symbolic. Janita, what would you say to those people? I mean, what are some of the intangible impacts that this kind of move can make?
Well, I just think it's important. I mean, we look at the United States. What is the United States, you know, is supposedly a beacon of liberty and freedom. And look at what we do. We have, you know, our structures that collude to take away any kind of psychological, economic progress for African Americans. So, you know, we can say one thing and do another thing. And for us, we wanted to put this out there because this is what we aspire to be. It's also important because, you know, I'm African American and I'm one of the few, I don't know how many other African Americans in our neighborhood. And, you know,
4%.
How would I feel? Thank you. And how would, you know, I would feel much better if I was able to walk in my neighborhood and see other people that look like me. And, you know, this is part of the change where we need to talk about this. We need to be, it's hard. These are difficult conversations, but the only way to heal from it is to not turn away from it. I think James Baldwin has a quote, and I'm not going to mangle it, but like, you know, you can't change if you don't face it. you know, if you face it, there's all you can do is change somehow and transform.
I know that quote is included a couple times in Shane's presentation.
Yeah.
And Shane, I'll turn to you next about the work of CORD continues with education. We're down to our last few minutes. You know, we have this abbreviated hour due to the governor, but I think everything you're talking about is so important. What's the next step for CORD and for your work regarding education, Shane?
So I think I really like what we're talking about with the silence that's gone on around this, or the minimizing of these issues, the decentering of racial injustice in our community. Oh, it's a small thing, or don't forget this other group was oppressed too, instead of centering it, owning it, like really reckoning with it. And I got to say, I'm like super impressed that the neighbors in Meadowbrook have finally come together to tell a bigger, a truer story about their neighborhood. I know for the last 5 years, I've been talking about the Meadowbrook neighborhood to hundreds of groups of people, and it's finally changed. I'm thrilled. I think it's a powerful symbolic change, but I hope their action is going to ripple through the hundreds of county neighborhoods who have stayed silent about these racist policies. And I also hope that the other majority white neighborhoods like this one, with these racist deeds, and those without these racist deeds, begin to acknowledge the ways that they're benefiting from and maintaining structural racism in our community. And I also, if I got to say, I just hope Meadowbrook's not done yet, that we really reckon with the work that we have yet to do in confronting inequality. To truly reckon with it means to repair the damage that was done. Yeah. One of my fourth graders looked at these deeds in Meadowbrook. Every year I've been teaching my students about this, and they wrote letters to the county clerk. They said, I think kids should learn about restrictive covenants in school. If kids learn about these covenants like those in Meadowbrook, maybe when they're older, they're going to change segregation and injustice in Rochester. So my challenge to the neighbors in Meadowbrook is, how are you going to answer my student? How will you ensure that every child in Brighton and in Monroe County learns about these racist deeds in your neighborhood and Council Rock Estates and so many others? Will they learn that racial discrimination isn't something of the past? Because of these federal policies, and like those in Meadowbrook, white people have 10 times more wealth than black. Mm-hmm. Meadowbrook's only 4% black. White families own homes in our community at 3 times the rate of black families. Brighton Schools is number 6 in the country when it comes to school segregation across district lines. That black kids in our region are 4 times as likely to live in poverty. 8,000 evictions a year in our community. We saw Miss Florence Yard be evicted from her home on a cold winter night right before Christmas with her children just on Friday. Like, I hope our kids come away when they learn about this and they say never again, and they say we have to change this now. And then adults, when their kids ask their parents and say, they say, why now? Why didn't we do this when we moved in? I hope adults in Meadowbrook and hundreds of neighborhoods admit their silence and show them that we can own up to our failures in our community, that we're brave enough to do that, that we can model with our example the reparation of this data. And the curriculum project, that's our hope, to equip parents and teachers and community members to talk about this with kids, but most importantly, to model with their example the ways they acknowledge it, talk about it, and take anti-racist systemic change, whether it's supporting land trusts, taking out these deeds, whether it's creating a housing trust fund with every deed that's filed at the county clerk's office, or the county, you know, setting someone up to be in charge of making sure every deed is recognized and digitized so no one doesn't know and there's no excuse about changing it. And I could go on, but those are some of the things that I'm really coming away with from this conversation.
Connor, we're down to our last minute. What would you like to add to Shane's thought process there?
The thing I would add is that, you know, I think there was a fear discussed earlier in this conversation about this being a fleeting moment where we'd look back in a year and nothing will have changed. And I think that the solution to, you know, it's same in the policing context. You know, we have this year, we have this moment. What happens in a few months when it gets cold, people aren't on the streets as much? And what I'll say is institutional change is how we get things done. And I have hopes for this community, because other communities have done this, you know, revoked these restrictions on a neighborhood by neighborhood level. What hasn't often happened is governmental change, because it was the governments that really made this stuff happen. And so what I'm hopeful for is we have, you know, people in the county clerk's office, people in the Monroe County legislature who are looking to enact systemic policies that maybe bring wealth back to black and brown communities through programs that can directly address the effects of these covenants. And so we will see. But this is a great first step.
Well, we will continue these conversations on Connections, both about policy, about what neighborhood groups are doing. And I want to end this conversation with a part of a quote from a little girl named Natalie who lives in Brighton. She says, people always say that it's the thought that counts. So even if it's not enforceable, if people are thinking about it that way, then it matters. So I want to thank our guests from the CORD Group, Janita Anthony and Kristen Dowdy. Thank you for your work. Thank you for sharing your process. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And also thanks to Shane Wiegand and Connor Dwyer Reynolds doing remarkable work in this community, educating the public, helping us walk through some of this stuff. Thank you both.
Thank you, Megan. And I share the report and the map of the neighborhood, so you can post it in the show notes if that's possible.
Perfect. Will do. Thanks so much.
Megan.
More Connections next.
Have a good one.